I was never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me. And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my nose ring.
Can we be happy?
Show me the mosh pit.
Can we be happy?
You are listening to The Underground, the monthly public affairs show put on by KBOO's Youth Collective. My name is Annie, and this month, our theme for the show is art. And we're going to start out with a piece by Margaret, and it is about art and propaganda.
Wikipedia defines art as something that usually implies some degree of aesthetic value, meaning art is commonly made for the beauty of the finished product. But what happens when art is made not just for the benefit of the artist or the public, but as a tool to shape the minds and views of the people? In May 2006, Fever Theatre presented a play that was a culmination of months of research and investigation of the question, when does art become dangerous? The play focused in part on Leni Riefenstahl, a German documentarist who worked for Hitler in the 1930s, and the fictional Pandemonium Institute, a residential center that uses artists to secretly create advertising. Recently, I spoke to three of the actors and musicians who worked on the project, Kate Sanderson, Joel Hawley, and Jacob Coleman. I asked them about their play, Mitlaffer, and also about art and propaganda in general. This is what they had to say.
Mitlaffer was an interactive musical theater piece, sort of, about the life of Leni Riefenstahl, who was known best for being a filmmaker who worked with Hitler and the Third Reich. She made a couple of really famous films, Triumph of the Will and Olympia. Triumph of the Will was one of the best known propaganda films for Hitler, but it's also known as being a really amazing piece of art. And we took her life as a jumping off point for this show to explore that theme of when does art become dangerous.
It's like kind of a shining example of art becoming dangerous is Leni Riefenstahl and how she became so disconnected from the content of it and became so attached to her technique and making something come across as really beautiful that she didn't even think about the ramifications of how it was being used. And I think in that way, if you watch Triumph of the Will, she does some amazing things and makes the Nazis look huge and powerful and beautiful and perfectly timed. And I think in that aspect, it's really the only time when it can become dangerous is when the artist will lose track of what it's being used for.
There's an analogy to be made. Whether you're Leni Riefenstahl in the 30s making documentaries, as she called them, about Nazis and claiming ignorance of their politics, or you're an artist today making art or using your talents to make advertising and claiming that it's just a paycheck. Look, here's something that happens in Leni Riefenstahl's life that she is very harshly judged for. And yet, something very analogous happens all the time all around us. Why do we so easily cast judgment on her but not on ourselves now?
It's really important for everyone to become media literate, which is kind of a new term that was not in people's vocabulary when Leni Riefenstahl was around. And it's only today that I'm hearing people talk about high school kids becoming media literate, which means they know how to look at an image or a video or a movie and sort of know how those images were put together in such a way that they're not as easily brainwashed by them. I think a filmmaker will do whatever they need to do to get their art complete or to get their message across. And lately, I guess I haven't been quite as interested in the idea of how do we get filmmakers to stop making propaganda, and I've been more interested in, like, how do we empower the people watching the film to know how to decipher them.
The difference, this is something we examined a lot in the course of making the play, between art and propaganda is telling and art is asking. Art asks a question and asks its audience, whatever that is, wherever they are, to answer that question for themselves. It raises questions in the head. Propaganda just tells people what to think.
Fever Theatre's current project, Billum Bay, will be showing for the rest of March on Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays at 8 o'clock. If you're interested in seeing the shows, go to fevertheatre.com. This piece has had the voices of Kate Sanderson, Joel Hawley, and Jacob Coleman, and I'm Margaret for the Youth Collective.
All right, and that was Margaret's piece about art and propaganda. So I like that piece a lot, Margaret.
As they just said, you know, this time of year, we're trying to keep our station running, and we're asking you guys just to give a little bit to help us out. And I don't know if you guys knew this, but if you're under 18, you can still get a youth membership. Or if you're an adult and you have kids, you can get your kids a youth membership. It's only
$10. $10.
That's like as much as going out for dinner at Denny's. Okay, that's $10. And we don't even ask for the money right away. You can call us 503-232-8818 or 1-877-500-KBOO. And you can just tell us. You can give us your information. We'll send you a bill. You can send us back the money, okay? We don't ask for it right up front. And if you don't have a phone, if you can't get to the phone right away, you can also go online. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, Margaret?
Yes. You can go online to www.kboo.fm and pledge there. And also, if you don't like have a credit card, you can come into the station in person and pay in cash.
And, you know, like I said, we don't ask for a whole lot. Anything that you can give us, we will take. I've taken pledges for $1 before. It's just a little bit helps out a lot. And we have a lot of people here that volunteer their time. All of us youth come in every week, and we volunteer our time to help you guys out and to give you guys this great programs that we give you. And, you know, your money doesn't go to paying big important people's checks. It goes to buying us equipment. It goes to keeping us on the air.
Yeah.
So just quickly, we're going to wrap it up here and get back to our pieces. But Margaret, can you give them those phone numbers one more time?
That's 503-232-8818. And out of the Portland area is 1-877-500-KBOO. That's 5266.
All right. And coming up next, we have a piece from Sen. He's a person who's been in the Youth Collective for a long time. And here's his interview with Adrian, who is a local youth author.
So what inspired the idea of an audiobook?
I really, really like the oral literary tradition because I think that literature started off as like oral storytelling around a fire with a community or a family and like sharing ideas and communicating and hanging out. And that's what the whole literary tradition is based on. And so I really, really believe in perpetuating that, and I don't think it gets done enough, because a lot of writing now is kind of about like isolation and reading by yourself, when I really think it's supposed to be a social thing, and I really, really believe in that, so I wanted to kind of pioneer that in the modern age.
Did Dustin compose music specifically for Stories with Snacks?
He wrote music specifically for the project. I called him one day and said, look, I really, really need you to do this for me. And within 5 days, he had written a whole bunch of little short, like, musical vignettes. And then we just kind of mixed and matched them with the different stories.
Did you tell him, like, what you're looking for? You're just like, I need music.
I said, I need music. And he knows a lot of my stories, so he kind of knew what kind of moods to go for. But he just made a whole bunch of music, and then we kind of decided which music piece went with which story.
Right.
So even if a story is based on true events or biographical or even autobiographical, do you take any creative license with what you write or how you portray it?
When I do write about real events, though, they are real events. Meaning that I'm writing about events that actually happen, of course, from my perspective, so I guess you could call that artistic license, but they're real. They happened. But I do a lot of fiction, too. And I also do a lot of, I guess you could call them biographical stories, not having to do with myself, but people who tell me a story, just totally randomly sit down and tell me a really, really interesting story. I often transcribe those and make those into stories, and I actually made a whole series of them, one of which is the first on my CD. It's called Jane's Story, and that's based on a very, very gripping story that a woman told me. So I like to do a lot of those, too. Real-life stories.
Stories with Snacks.
Yeah.
What inspired that title?
Because the last time I can remember having the oral literary tradition, a big part of my life, was in elementary school when we would all sit on the carpet and have our paper towels with a little handful of Cheez-Its or pretzels and listen to the teacher read us a story. It's just this collective of little kids intently listening to a story and eating snacks. That's what I want the world to be like. That's what literacy should be like.
That's a pretty beautiful goal.
So stories with snacks.
Stories with snacks.
That's where it comes from.
So you said you've been published?
Yes.
And what was published? This.
Which stories?
Or like, was the... Was
a whole bunch. I mean, all, like, different places. Like a couple of books, like anthologies of short stories and some magazines and some small literary journals.
And so you said that this Stories with Snacks is available at Powell's?
It is, for $5, right near the magazine section.
And when's your next public appearance, if any?
None at all. I wish. I might be appearing in Michelle T's book that's coming out in January called Some Words on Fashion, Feminism, and Personal Style. But that's all I know.
Cool.
Otherwise, I'll just be working on the down low.
Okay. Well, if someone wishes you to make a public appearance, how could they get in touch with you?
They could email me at adrian.shirk, that's adrian.shirk, at gmail.com. I would love anyone who's interested to get a hold of me. Even if you just want to chat or talk about writing, definitely.
Stories with Snacks by Adrian Shirk. Music by Dustin Dibvig. Jane's Story.
It was 1973 or 74, I'm not sure. I was 20, maybe. Me and a couple of friends were delivering furniture to this old classmate of ours in Jacksonville, Florida. Patty Reagan was her name. And it was just one of those beautiful days, you know. The sun was perfectly smooth and warm over our bodies. I was clean and sober, wearing this pink string bikini, laying in the waves. God. The waves lapped up over my thighs, and it was so warm. I watched these little orange fish jump right over my legs, you know? Hop, hop, hop. I could run my fingers through the wake, and they'd swim around my hands. So anyway, me and my friends got really hungry around 3 p.m, and we climbed up to the boardwalk. There was this pizza parlor that doubled as a bar. It was called the Mother Goose, and had this light-up sign of an enormous woman sitting on a nest of neon eggs. Ugh, that was totally weird. I even thought so then. So, I slip a big red t-shirt over my bikini, looking pretty unobtrusive, I thought, and walked inside. It was really dark and smoky, and there were hippies everywhere. I swear, every single person in there was stoned, or on drugs, or something. God, it was just so weird. We ordered a pizza and then pulled up these wobbly metal stools to sit and wait. And then I noticed these two guys sitting at the bar. They looked like they were in their 50s or something, considerably older than everyone there, and they were wearing, like, old-fashioned golfing clothes, checkered slacks, tweed hats, the works. And they were drinking liqueur from these tiny blue vials. I mean, really fancy liqueur in this dark, shabby pizza place. It was just so weird, you know? While we were waiting for our pizza, those men started yelling terrible carnal oaths at women that would pass by. The worst stuff I've ever heard. I'd repeat it if there weren't ladies in the room. Absolutely disgusting. Well, I guess there was a hole in the bottom piece of my bathing suit. I heard them say something about it, and then I realized that they'd been talking about me the entire time. They were relentless. I was like, Patty, do you hear that? And she was one of those girls who didn't like trouble. She didn't want me to make a scene, so she just hissed that I should ignore them. But they kept going. Christ, they were saying awful stuff. I walked up to this huge Greek guy behind the bar and I said, Hey, those guys over there are harassing me. Can you do something? And this Greek guy was like 7 feet tall and had tree trunks for arms. But he glanced where I pointed and all he did was shrug and walk off. He didn't want to deal with it. I looked around the restaurant and realized that no one else was acknowledging these two men who, by the way, were still yelly things. Well, it had been such a pleasant day up to that point that I finally just sat down with my friends and let the two men yell to their heart's content. And I watched them get their pizza and stand up to leave, holding the box in front of them. Thank God, I thought. But on their way out of the parlor, one of them stopped right behind my seat. I swear the whole place, all those stoned hippies, they looked up. Everything was quiet. This guy bounces the pizza box on my head once. Pop. I'm so humiliated, all I can do is sit there. I think, come on, it's almost over, they'll leave in just a second. This day was too nice to ruin now. He bounces it a second time. Pop. Silence. Everyone was waiting for me to do something. I just shook my head and waited for his exit. The guy bounces it on my head a third time, and then everything went black. I remember leaping from my chair and taking him by the neck and, like, slamming his head against the wall like 15 times. I was screaming at him, I don't even know what. Pulling at his hair, using my nails. Everything came into focus maybe 30 seconds later, and I had my legs wrapped around him and his neck pinned to the wall. Everyone was completely silent, staring at me, so I slowly climbed off of him one leg at a time, adjusted my shirt, and sat back down at my table. I'd never done anything like that before. And later, out in the parking lot, those men drove by as we walked out to our van, and the one had an ice pack to his cheekbone, and his friend leaned out the window all white in the face and said, "Lady, you've got a problem." And I was like, "I've got a problem?" I couldn't believe I lived in a world where a man like that could tell me I'm flawed. That whole experience really exemplified the 70s for me. That night, my friends and I were in a hotel room downtown watching the news, and the news anchor, this pretty redhead, finishes up the newscast and says, "This will be my last night working on Channel 2. I have to leave for a while. I have some family matters to clear up." And then she picked up a gun and shot herself in the head. I was looking away from the TV at the moment it happened. When I turned around, she was falling to the floor, and then the screen went blank.
So that piece, I recorded that last year. So the January she mentioned about appearing in the book, that was last January. Yeah, I just want to make that clear.
So, again, that was an interview with San, and he interviewed a local youth author, Adrian Shirk. Up next is a girl. What is that?
It's a gorilla.
Gorilla theater?
Gorilla theater.
Gorilla theater.
A gorilla theater piece. And why don't you tell us about that, Zoe?
It's a program that works out of outside in. And
yeah. All right. Let's listen to it.
My name is Darlene, and I'm the Gorilla Theater facilitator. This allowed us an opportunity to be able to bring to reality the things that we deal with on a daily basis that people want to dismiss because we live in a comfort level right now where folks are just kind of live and let live and forgetting about those that are less fortunate. And this is an opportunity to be able to put those voices that really deal with those things up close and personal. Jupiter put it all into words.
My name may or may not be of any pertinent relevance or vitality in comparison with my life or how it may be. But what's in a name? Does it truly signify who you are and what kind of life you lead? Or rather, is it the actions of the individual behind that name that dictates who they truly are? I know my actions have done just such, but do they solely determine who I am, what I am, or what I have been through in my life to bring me to this particular point in time? You see, in a life lived on the streets, one endures many things that others could not possibly fathom, and we all share similar stories, relative and general aspects only differing by the individual's experiences. The experiences that in large part mold the people we become. But who do we want to become? How do we want to be known and viewed by the world? Or does it even matter? I've come to find that, despite how I may want to be seen and thought of by others, is regardless to how it will really be. People will always have their own opinions, their personal judgments. You look at me and you think you know me. think that just because you do know my name, you know anything about me. Believe that simply because you've seen me at times when I was wilding out, when I was high or coming down, flipping out, getting thrown, slammed down to the ground and cussed by cops, that you know anything about me. Or how I truly am deep down within my heart, my mind, my body, my soul, my being. A being that much of the time is a facade, an outward performance of a secure, cocky, egotistical motherfucker who's got it all under control. I present myself as a strong, unwavering individual, always there to reach out with a helping hand to one in dire need, if a cry for aid is never to be heard from my lips. Is this what I am? Is this how you see me? The camouflage behind which I shelter my form, this frail, mortal form of a boy lost. His spirit tattered and torn, soul forever scarred by memories and everlasting marks on my arms. The hepatitis C now running through my bloodstream due to the sharing of dirty IVs. A dark drug fantasy I've lived within on cold, hard streets. A nightmare I have finally decided I no longer wish to dream. For that person you have all seen and known me to be, regardless of my name or that person in all of your eyes that I became, was never truly me. That was the monologue, Me, from the performance My Life, My Face. It's basically a script about life on the streets and different individuals' struggles and their own experiences within living on the streets. I just basically put this script together just to try and get these ideas out there, get these truths and these happenings of reality out there to the public eye, because it's something that really is not seen or not expressed enough and not viewed by the majority of the populace. This was My Life, My Face.
You can reach us, Guerrilla Theater. My email is darlenes@outsidein.org.
Again, that email is darlenes@outsidein.org, or you can find them on MySpace. All right, we are going to go to another pitch break. All right, thanks, guys. Next up, we have a piece by Zoe L. Do you want to tell us about it, Zoe?
Hi, my name is Zoe, and I did an interview with Guy Merrill about his art.
Hello, my name is Zoe Loringer, and I'm interviewing Guy.
Hi.
What's your name?
My name is Guy Palmer Merrill.
How old are you?
I will be 24 on August 26th.
How long have you been making art?
My whole life.
What made you want to start making art?
Well, I think it was more of just a thing that I always did. Ever since I was a little kid, I would just draw on stuff and keep drawing and kind of obsess over drawing on things. And I never really stayed inside the lines.
What kind of art do you do?
Right now, my stuff is mostly, well, I'm doing a lot of painting, oil painting, drawing, like pen and ink drawing. I have done a lot of graphite, so like graphite, pen and ink, and oil painting.
What's your definition of art?
That's a hard thing because I think art is something that people have done forever, and I think it's really the thing that makes human beings human beings. Some people say that it's the communication of ideas or emotions. I think that's part of it, but I think it's something more. It's deeper in what we are as people. I think it has to do with our need to affect our environment, our need to change the world around us, and our need to manipulate things that we see in front of us. And I think that's deeply ingrained in what we are as creatures or human beings or whatever. So, my definition of art, is it communication? Yes, but on the other hand, you could say if somebody asks you if a painting that was never seen before is still art, before nobody ever saw it, before it was a communication, is it art then? I would say yes, because that person made it. It's a long conversation, really. It's hard to answer with one question.
Have you went to school for art?
Yeah, had a lot of art schooling. Actually, when I was in middle school, I had an illustration class when I was like in seventh grade, and then I went to the Vancouver School of Arts and Academics, which is a middle school and high school, so I was actually there for 4.5 years. And then I went to college at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, and got a BA in Mixed Media Studio Art, where I learned a lot of different stuff.
What is your favorite subject to draw or paint?
Well, I think my stuff involves sort of the realms of the unreal. Things that are kind of like dreamlike but realistic, because this thing that comes out of like a cultural experience that I have. I'm seeing things in the world and in my head, and I represent them in certain ways. You know what I mean? And the way that I'm doing things is, I don't know. I mean, I could show you. I know it's showing pictures on the radio is awesome, but this is called One Beautiful Eve. It's a really new drawing I just did, and a lot of my stuff kind of has like a dark look to it. But what I'm trying to do, it's dreamlike. It's okay. So in this picture, so I can describe it. There's a figure, sort of like with outstretched arms, like as if like gesturing, like large, big or something. We're his back's to us. He's standing in like an arched architectural space, like some kind of ruin or something, and looking out onto this horizon line that's kind of dark. And I want to suggest when this actually becomes a painting, I want to suggest sort of like a sunset. But I like the idea of taking something that's I don't know, beautiful, you know, something that would be classically like, this is a beautiful image, you know what I mean? Oh my, you know, oh my, look at this. But then twisting it a little bit, maybe not in an over the top way, but in a subtle way, or taking something that might be, you know, kind of like nightmarish, but then making it more beautiful and making it more illustrious. I think that's really interesting to me. So that's sort of, I also have all these drawings of trees that don't have trunks and just like these roots and things that are flying around in the air. So yeah, in the fantasy realm, but not a fantasy and not anything in particular. It's something that's, I guess, it's still forming. another long answer to a short question.
Do you ever use the come see my studio to get girls to come into your bedroom?
No. Yes.
Thank you for taking your time to be on the KBOO Youth Radio Show. This is Zoe with KBOO Underground signing off. Again, that was Zoe interviewing Guy Merrill.
All right, up next we have a piece by Jennifer, and it is about the art of protest.
I'm Jennifer, and this is a piece on art and politics. I believe that art in all forms is important as a means of self-expression, a way of making life more beautiful, and as a device to make people question and think. But now, with such horrible things happening in the world as the Iraq War, art that addresses real issues becomes the most necessary of all. Because not only does it tell people to wake up and become aware of what's going on, but it also shows them how something paralyzing and scary has the potential to start something empowering, vibrant, and rad. Where would the 60s have been without the Vietnam War? While I'm not advocating war, oppression, or injustice, in fact, quite the opposite, these things give artists a jumping-off place for creativity and help them try to prevent these atrocities from happening. What better place to see this that kind of positivity than at an anti-war rally? Last Sunday, I went to the 4th annual anti-war in Iraq rally and met amazing artists from all walks of life.
Right now, next to the statue of Abraham Lincoln, and there are a bunch of people, and they're coloring with like a lot of multicolored sidewalk chalk, and it says, "The only war is the war against creativity. Dream, love, live."
All you vets out there, we got our vets.
Well, we're just, I think chalk art is great. It's a really great way to, you know, create art quickly and something that everybody can really enjoy. And attaching a message to it is a good way to, I don't know, kind of get your idea across, what you're trying to say. And I think, hey, I don't know, if we're all more creative and maybe I can inspire more people just to enjoy and want to create, and that's all I'm really trying to do.
What they represent is their crying or mourning Iraqi and American mothers, mourning the loss of their children in the war and the loss of everyone's children. And then the coffins that we have set up represent the the American and Iraqi lives lost. And then the signs that say 50-1 represent the ratio by the government estimates, which are far lower than the Lancet reports. The government estimate is 150,000 dead Iraqis, and the Lancet report, which is the leading journal of British medicine, is 650,000. Out here.
Okay, over here I'm in front of the Art Museum and I'm watching the pots and pans for Peace Brigade. There's a bunch of people, they're banging on marimba drums. It's a pretty awesome sight. And it says, this weapon kills the auto industry. I'm gonna check it out a little more. Yeah, it's kind of like a cart type thing. Maybe like something to the effect of a rickshaw, and it's got a bunch of drums on it.
Roots and Shoots movement. The doves are, there's thousands of them all over the world, and these are some that were built by the Roots and Shoots group at the Unitarian Church in Hillsboro. They're all made of recycled materials and were made by kids. They've flown in several parades now. This one here actually was on stage with Jane Goodall on her last visit to speak.
Okay.
Anything else?
Face painting is really just a hobby I have. I'm really just a painter in general. But I was getting my face painted and they looked really swamped. So I asked if I could help and they handed me a brush. I thought it was pretty cool that I could... I really love putting my art on things that are alive, so putting my art on people is really awesome, especially since it's for an awesome cause. Back with the drummers, now there's some crazy dancing going on. A lot of people with face paint and like flowing skirts and dreadlocks, smelling a lot of incense, and over there is a guy meditating. So some people banging on pots and pans, and they've got signs that say, cooks not crooks. There are also some enormous puppets walking around. There's a gold one and a purple one. I'm not sure exactly what they're in reference to, because I feel kind of weird about going up and talking to a puppet. But I was talking to a woman earlier who was arranging the caskets, and I believe that those two are related. Okay, I was thinking about this, and I find it very ironic that on the one hand, we're protesting this horrible war and these atrocities that are happening all the time, but at the same time, it's this really fun, like, creative, vibrant thing that's going on. So it just seems ironic that, like, the war is what spawns us to do this.
All right, again, that was a piece by Jennifer on the art of protest. Back to you, Noah and Jeff. All right, thanks, guys. Up next, we have Zoe A's piece about an author from Chicago.
Christopher Gutierrez, born and raised in and around Chicago, Illinois. Although by some, he's expected to be a civilian, he still remains the punk rock straight-edge kid he's always been. The majority of Chris's money comes from doing hair on Michigan Avenue, though he has proven to be an amazing author. Currently, he has one spoken word CD, The Dirt of an Electric Boy, one book, On the Upswing of Life, Love, and Regret, and a second book in the works, tentatively titled A Life Deliberate. At first, the majority of Chris's internet fanbase may have been Take This to Your Grave fans. He now has a hardcore fanbase all to himself, resulting in the start of his own street team. Chris stays connected through his live journal, askheychris.livejournal.com, updating frequently each week with motivational rants or posts about teenage-like antics. As it says on the front of Chris's first book, his stories are true tales of mayhem and awesomeness, whereas his spoken word CD has more of a motivational feel to it, with tracks about being a waste of potential, love, passion, and accomplishment. His next book is expected to be almost twice the length of his first, with pictures and heart-wrenching stories laced between the laughing-inducing ones.
The problem is, I'm normal. And I think that sometimes people, coworkers, friends, and lurkers forget that I am. I've always maintained that I'm flawed and vulnerable. And I've always said, no one wants to hear you whine. And that's true. but you can only hold your chin up for so long. Every day someone asks me for advice. It still baffles me that someone would trust my opinion. I understand because of the persona I give off, but meet me in person, and I wish I had a nickel for every disappointed face. Someone asked me in a phone interview the other day who I thought Hey Chris was. Honestly, I didn't know how to answer it. I can tell you that I'm the old dude who still refers to himself and his friends as kids. I wake up with the same fears I had 10 years ago. That I hate my hair and my skin. That I only feel remotely attractive about once a month. That I'm self-conscious about my midsection. That I often think I'm wasting my potential. That no one is impressed with me after meeting me for 10 minutes. That I couldn't write my way out of a third-grade book fair. And if there wasn't such a thing as spell check, you would all know that I'm a true retard. And that I should take more of my own advice. What I do know is that I will never release the guilt I have for anyone that I've fooled into loving me. That somehow I coaxed a few out of my league girls into loving me with an artful array of smoke and mirrors who, when faced with the harsh realization that they were sleeping next to a greasy-faced false promise, it was already too late. And that's hard for me to live with. Every day, at some point, I think about how I can be a better friend, son, or boyfriend, and how I'm doing a horrendous job. This isn't one of your trite, self-loathing posts about how, oh, no one loves poor little Chris. It's a post about a genuine belief that I don't deserve the people around me. This isn't subjective. This is fact. Or boyfriend. And how I'm doing a horrendous job. This isn't one of your trite, self-loathing posts about how, oh, no one loves poor little Chris. It's a post about a genuine belief that I don't deserve the people around me. This isn't subjective. This is fact. And that's true. But you can only hold your chin up for so long. Every day someone asks me for advice. It still baffles me that someone would trust my opinion. I understand because of the persona I give off. But meet me in person, and I wish I had a nickel for every disappointed face. Someone asked me in a phone interview the other day who I thought Hey Chris was. Honestly, I didn't know how to answer it. I can tell you that I'm the old dude who still refers to himself and his friends as kids. I wake up with the same fears I had 10 years ago. That I hate my hair and my skin. That I only feel remotely attractive about once a month. That I'm self-conscious about my midsection. That I often think I'm wasting my potential. That no one is impressed with me after meeting me for 10 minutes. That I couldn't write my way out of a third-grade book fair. And if there wasn't such a thing as spell check, you would all know that I'm a true retard. And that I should take more of my own advice. What I do know is that I will never release the guilt I have for anyone that I've fooled into loving me. That somehow I coaxed a few out of my league girls into loving me with an artful array of smoke and mirrors who, when faced with the harsh realization that they were sleeping next to a greasy-faced false promise, it was already too late. And that's hard for me to live with. Every day, at some point, I think about how I can be a better friend, son, or boyfriend, and how I'm doing a horrendous job. This isn't one of your trite, self-loathing posts about how, oh, no one loves poor little Chris. It's a post about a genuine belief that I don't deserve the people around me. This isn't subjective. This is fact. I realized how easy it is to be a bad person. And that's when you end up like me.
All right, that was an interview by Zoe A. with an author. This is a calendar of events for the following month. Last Thursday, a monthly street fair of arts, crafts, and music is tomorrow on Northeast Alberta Street and goes pretty much all evening and into the night. For more information, visit www.artonalberta.org. See you there. Minimalism and Post-Minimalism, selections from the collections of Jordan D. Schnitzer, a new exhibition at the Portland Art Museum, opens this Saturday, March 31st. The exhibition showcases printmaking, an integral part of minimalist and post-minimalist practice. For more info, visit www.portlandart.org. The Portland Grid Project, an exhibition of over 3,000 photographs of Portland by 21 photographers over the last 12 years, opens Thursday, April 5th at the Portland Art Center. For more information and to see the images, visit www.portlandgridproject.com. April is National Poetry Month. Celebrate by attending various poetic events sponsored by Multnomah County Library. Join Haiku Inferno Tuesday, April 3rd at 7 p.m. at Central Library and Tuesday, April 10th at 7 at North Portland Library and enjoy rapid-fire haiku with a dangerous mixture of political satire and surreal Dadaism, as well as demonstrations on collage, origami, and more. For more info, please visit www.multcolive.org. The Bustling Townships are playing two shows next week, one at the Clinton Street Theater on April 4th at 8 p.m., and one on Friday, April 6th at Lewis and Clark College with the Helio Sequence. For more info, visit www.myspace.com/thebustlingtownships. Thanks for listening to The Underground. The Underground is hosted every fourth Wednesday by the KBOO Youth Collective. We meet every Wednesday at KBOO at 6 p.m. to plan our show. If you're interested in getting involved, come on down or call our youth advocate, Aaron Yankee, at 503-231-8032, extension 511, or email her at kbooyouth@hotmail.com. We also do a music show, Youth Randomonium, the last Friday of every month from 11 to midnight, and we're always looking for new music by anyone under 21 of any style. Check out our website at kbooyouth.org. The first and third Wednesdays of the month, Circle A Radio airs at this time, and the second Wednesday of the month, Hole in the Bucket, a public affairs show on homelessness, airs from 6 to 7. Next up is DJ Audio with Nonstop Hip Hop. Thanks for listening.